and 28 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, featuring Easter candy, new apparel, and garden accessories in its recently remodeled gift shop. Open Monday through Friday from 9 until 6 and Saturday from 9 until 5. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient eating and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very happy to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, Director of the Clawson Center, author of After the Cold War, and someone who regularly visits the morning show to offer his perspective on a wide variety of topics of interest related to issues both here and around the world. And there is a tremendous amount to speak about today. So, Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's always nice to be with you.
Glad to have you here. I want to start with Foxconn. Last night, as we have been reporting during Morning Edition today, there was a sort of public forum that occurred at Carthage College, and it is actually the third in a series of meetings at Carthage related to Foxconn. And I know you were a participant, a very direct participant for sure in last night's meeting, and perhaps a participant and certainly an organizer of the meetings that happened before that. I wonder if you could maybe just sketch for our listeners what these public forums have entailed or the ways in which they have tried to address the coming of Foxconn to this part of the state, and then in particular what was said and shared and explored last night.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. Actually, credit for that, not only the concept but organization should go to two of our younger colleagues, much younger colleagues in my case. Two other young guys about your age, sir, Darwin Sen from Modern Languages, and who's from Taiwan. Hmm. And by coincidence, Foxconn is a Taiwan-based company, though truly global in impact. And Eric Johnson, a younger economist and in the economics department and therefore physically based in our Clausen Center at the north end of campus. They really conceived of this series, part of one of two main dimensions of our Clausen Center's strategy from the beginning has been to not only generate information, but also develop information and do analyses of important changes going on economically, but also demographically, socially, politically in our immediate region. And not only is the subject inherently important, and we'd therefore be as supportive as possible, but it also fits ideally with our larger mission.
You were telling me that the first meeting was, in your words, a mob scene. That is, so many people showing up that there actually wasn't room for everybody, and the form had to be shifted into a different space. And that says a lot about the importance of this issue and people's interest in it.
Yes. Well, fortunately, we assumed it would be the usual relatively small group that we characteristically draw. It was my mistake not to anticipate this kind of large crowd, but thanks to Mike Murphy and our library, who had confirmed that we did have a larger space available, and our senior leadership, President Swallow, and Paul Hegland, his special assistant, were armed with our cell phones. I was so complacent, I was completely unarmed. We moved fairly expeditiously, given the size of the crowd, to a larger venue, and thanks to cell phone logistical practicality, why everything worked out okay.
So
it's the kind of problem to have, as I was careful to point out to President Swallow. Naturally, we all agreed that this is better than having two senior citizens my age and a dog and a couple of students sitting there. That experience has also occurred, but we had larger venue in our Todd Ware Center for the next two meetings, and it turned out to be the right. And we had made accommodations for larger audio feeds if necessary.
Great. So what kinds of things were explored at last night's event?
Well, we had Ron Kronovich from the economics department. Thank you very much to you and Dave McGrath and the staff here for featuring his remarks on this morning's news. President Swallow, as usual, opened the meeting. Dave DeGroote had a very informative, president of the board, the head of Mount Pleasant's government, local government, was good enough to appear and had very informative remarks on the positive dimensions of the investment, and several others. We've had community activists at both, at two of the three panels, which also added considerably, I think. In terms of diversity of point of view, I'm very happy that we certainly included different perspectives and people from the community who were very concerned, understandably, about this very, very substantial corporate investment were there.
So, in your mind, is this something that we should be excited about? Is this good news?
Yes. I that's my own personal opinion. As usual, in the real world, as opposed to the theoretical world where some of us academics operate, and we're lucky to be able to do so, there's both good news and bad news for any substantial corporate investment, especially in the manufacturing field, even high tech, and this certainly defines Foxconn's role, companies, as opposed to old-fashioned, much more heavy-duty and much more polluting manufacturing industries. It's complicated in terms of the impact. But the most important point, perhaps, to make is Foxconn is a very visible tip of an iceberg of a substantial, I mean really enormous, long-term procession of established companies and also new companies to this immediate area, southeast Wisconsin, over the past two decades, has benefited and will continue to benefit from a tremendous amount of investment, and the importance of location was also addressed at the meeting yesterday, which went on from 4 in the afternoon to 6 in the about 6 in the evening by the time everybody departed.
I remember Brian Albrecht, who's the president of Gateway Technical College, and of course Gateway is very likely to play a major role in the training of employees for Foxconn. I remember very early on in the process him characterizing this as a game changer for southeastern Wisconsin, and I think he chose those terms to characterize this as mostly a game changer in a very positive sense. Of course, game changing can be towards the negative as well, and particularly when we're weighing things like environmental concerns and so on. Particularly for people who have those kind of concerns about the environmental problems that might be wrapped up in something like this, what reassurance can there be that those concerns are going to be heard and addressed and reflected in how this construction goes forth from here?
Well, Brian's choice of words, as usual, was particularly apropos, as you well know, because we all get to read and hear his remarks, and you have him on the radio as well regularly. That's still to be seen. It's the nature of the marketplace that no one knows. Some people make better guesses than others what will happen. But it's important, especially for those most concerned about pollution, to keep in mind that we have quite strict, historically extremely strict environmental standards in the United States, thanks significantly to President Richard Nixon. Now, that changes during the Reagan administration and during the current administration. One can see efforts to tone down or weaken or make less stringent those regulations. But EPA, like a lot of other Nixon initiatives and policy, has proven to be remarkably durable. We also have a State Department of Natural Resources, which is more a source of concern, it's fair to say, by people who are concerned about environmental matters, but the law remains. Mr. DeGroote pointed out, among other things, that while Foxconn will be using a lot of water, Lake Michigan, of course, has a lot of water, and the consumption in this immediate area, Mount Pleasant and environs, has actually gone down in recent years, so it will not be in any way an unprecedented or unmanageable diversion use of water. I was also impressed by the fact that Mr. DeGroote was extremely well informed concerning not only the standards but also the procedures that the company uses to clean up water that they use and make sure that any water that's returned to public use facilities is cleaner than when it was acquired. Now that's a point of view, and I really don't know enough to have a strong opinion on the environmental dimension. Ron Kronovich has very strong involvement. He and Jerry Mast from our political science department are co-authoring a book currently on environmental policy matters. And my own opinion, as a non-expert, is I'd be surprised if there are any significant violations of environmental regulations. And if there were, they'd be handled very, very quickly.
For those of you just joining us, in the studios today is Dr. Art Sear-Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, paying his monthly visit to the morning show. One other question about Foxconn, and then we're going to get on to
it's very important,
more than one, if you wish, sure. One of the remarks quoted in our newscast this morning was about the fact that one of the facts trumpeted about Foxconn is that it's 13,000 jobs that are coming to the area. And I don't remember which Carthage professor was quoted as saying that, yes, 13,000 jobs are being posted. That doesn't necessarily mean, in fact, it almost certainly does not mean that 13,000 people from this part of Wisconsin or from Wisconsin at all are going to be able to fill those 13,000 jobs. And so one way to look at this is that we are footing the bill for something that is not going to always directly or in a perfectly focused way benefit us. And that being said, I wonder, apart from that complication, the fact that it's really hard to know exactly how many people will be employed and or where those employees will actually come from. Beyond the matter of the jobs, what is the benefit for the citizens of Wisconsin from an economic point of view with Foxconn going forward? Because surely there are benefits beyond just the jobs.
You've got a lot of, you've actually got a lot of different questions and points there. To start at the beginning of your comment, footing the bill implies you're buying a product. We buy products that we think will be useful to us, or at least we want them. I was impressed at how Dave DeGroote, like a good defense attorney, he's obviously he's a senior public official and should be. I was impressed by the fact that he addressed that dimension in considerable detail. There are all kinds of ancillary services. I don't know what they will be in detail, and nobody knows, but in terms of transportation, in terms of basic raw materials, in terms of food service, in terms of messenger service, in terms of sweeping and mopping floors, there are all kinds of jobs, including the popular and important computer and related technology jobs that the company will bring. To get at your last point, we have impacted unemployment here. There was repeated reference to the current 4% unemployment rate nationwide. There are a lot of people who've dropped off the worker rolls, and by no means just young people. A lot of older people, including especially older males, are just no longer participating in the workforce.
They've given up. They've given up.
Drawing in people who, for psychological as well as cruel economic reasons, are just having a lot of trouble finding a job. That's a big challenge for all of us. 20%, one of my favorite facts that I may have first heard from President Albrecht many years ago, is that 20% of all truck maintenance jobs in this area are available. One-fifth are always available. During the Great Recession, one-fifth of all truck maintenance jobs are open.
Wow.
Being a mechanic is no longer just a good guy with a oily rag and a screwdriver and a wrench. You really do need to know computer science. And there are a lot of people who are unemployed because they lack those skills. Their motivation is a factor, and conservatives like to beat that drum. But also the skills. I'm someone who's serious about his work. Fortunately, I don't need to run a lot of algorithms. I don't need to do computer analysis to keep my job. But I steadily plug away at learning more because that's the future. But it's not that easy for a lot of people, including me. I'm certainly not a high-tech guy. I'm very lucky that I've been able to stay employed. And that's a dimension we should all worry about. And it relates to social service agencies as well as education, even more than what's available in the business community. And I hope that we can, a test for all of us will be the degree to which we can take advantage of this new investment that's already here. I mean, ground's being broken, roads are being widened and changed, people's houses and farms are being purchased, it's already here. The degree to which we as Americans can help other people, I think, will be the basic test. I hope that's clear. It's not concrete. It's not statistical, but it's the most important matter for all of us, in this country especially.
Right. I thought it was interesting, too. This reminds me of a conversation that just aired on Tuesday with President Albrecht and one of the deans here at Gateway and someone else who's been a very important partner in the whole realm of manufacturing. And they were the main topic was advanced manufacturing and the way in which the typical factory of today is so dramatically different from the factory of even 10 years ago, let alone 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, with the sort of technology that is in place, including robotic technology and other things. And what's intriguing is that even with some of the automation and so on that's going on that is eliminating certain jobs, there's kind of all kinds of other jobs that remain and even new jobs being created. The difference is, you know, what you said, it's not just a matter of somebody standing in front of an assembly line and screwing on a bolt. It is more sophisticated, also more interesting, more stimulating work for that factory worker, but they have to know how to do it. I mean, it requires a certain level of expertise, and that does mean a new sort of gauntlet for certain people who want to remain relevant in this new world of manufacturing.
I think that's a particularly important point because jobs, the old assembly line jobs, half century ago and even more recently in Kenosha, Wisconsin, you could finish high school or finish the eighth grade, which used to be the standard before the 50s in this great country, believe it or not, and get a job on the Chrysler line. You had union security, you had a high wage, and you were set for life. It was difficult work. It was very monotonous work. Those jobs are gone. The job has not been picked up and taken to China or Mexico or Indonesia. An awful lot of political rhetoric, including but not exclusively from President Trump during the campaign, emphasizes that very false point. But that's not true. Those jobs are gone. They're not coming back.
They don't exist there either.
Right. They're heavily automated. For piece work, for routine assembly work of a very rudimentary sort, yeah, jobs are available in third world countries. But they're not the same as old-fashioned assembly line jobs. And it's extremely important for Americans to understand that point because obviously it has a lot of political resonance. There are very important elections coming up, as always, including a U.S. Senate seat in Indiana. I pick up, as I'm out and about for Carthage College and commuting, I pick up Indiana radio as well as Wisconsin and Illinois, and that's a constant refrain of one Republican Senate candidate in Indiana. It's just not true. Excuse me, jobs are also a lot safer. As usual, I'm kind of going on, but this is really important. Before World War I, one out of every 10 German steelworkers was killed on the job.
Wow.
If a unit has 10% deaths in combat, that's extraordinarily high. Some combat units, especially American, simply historically can't function if the death rate, as well as about 30 to 40% wounded, is that high. Going to work in Germany was like going to war. This was only a century ago.
It was worse than going to war.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely right.
In terms of the risk of loss of life, it was worse than going to war, which really says something.
Because you're working to survive, but it's not it's a job. That's
right.
All. And industrial work was extremely dangerous. If you were an industrial worker in the 1930s in this country, in many sectors, including the auto industry, and tried to organize, there was a very good chance that a man would be badly beaten, threatened, he might be killed. Chicago is extremely well laid out, thanks to something called the Burnham Plan. As probably most of our listeners who've been in the downtown area and surrounding areas in Chicago, they are, in practical terms, aesthetic terms, it's extremely well laid out. Just over 100 years ago, early in the 20th century, the big business community organized around urban planning because the railroads had become so powerful and so dangerous, they were doing whatever they wanted to. Three people a day, not a year, three people a day were being killed in Chicago from unmarked railroad crossings. Principal railroad companies had plans to build freight yards and warehouses right along Lake Michigan. If you cause trouble for the railroads, I mentioned community activists at our meetings, they would beat you up. If you persisted, they'd kill you. It was a cost of doing business. We didn't commit murder. He was making trouble, and we're actually performing a public service. The degree to which things have changed, actually, we focus on the negative because we're human. The degree to which things have changed, especially in this country, is extraordinary.
Right, and that is a story that needs to be told.
Well, thank you for putting up with me. Yeah, but that's important,
partly
because you never hear it.
Right, right. And back to Foxconn for just a second. In our conversation with Brian Albrecht the other day, one of the things that was mentioned is that Foxconn, and likely this facility to be built here in Mount Pleasant, is among the most technologically integrated of any factory in the world, in terms of the latest advancements and all that we were just talking about. And nevertheless, there's the potential for 13,000 jobs in this facility.
Yeah, exactly.
So this
well, technology multiplies jobs, but you don't have the security of going to work and doing the same old thing every day, and Dad did the same, and Granddad did the same.
Right.
That world is gone.
Right. And it might not be the job that you know how to do right now, but there are pathways in order to become equipped to do that job. At least that's the hope. I mean, that's the theoretical possibility.
Yeah, and given what you and I do for work and our particular assembly lines, which are most enjoyable, one of the things that I'm very glad to see is clear institutional collaboration in including Brian, but also John Swallow from Carthage, Deborah Ford from UW Parkside. Clearly, there's a dynamic at work that seems to me to be reinforced by this investment.
Absolutely. That they're going to all be exciting players in whatever comes next. And of course, time will tell what comes next. All kinds of other things to talk about. Let's talk about Russia.
Yes, I've heard of that country.
Oh my, I'm sure you have, especially recently. So first of all, what do you make of the controversy surrounding the fact that President Trump went against the advice of most of his close advisors, as far as we can tell, and went out of his way to congratulate President Vladimir Putin on his recent re-election to another 6-year term as the president of Russia. Do you see much significance in what President Trump did in that moment?
Well, it makes the media happy because they have yet more dribbles, morsels to gobble up and take up time and be outraged about in many cases. He's succeeded, as far as I can tell, partly because he's such a contrarian, and his base loves it, and all the outrage and hostility, his base loves it. I believe he can get reelected. I'm a very humble professor lately because I didn't think he could get nominated, to say nothing of being elected, as I've mentioned before in your program. But he did get elected, despite many hurdles to surmount. And if he's going to get reelected, and I think he can, he's going to energize his base, including a lot of Americans, millions of our fellow Americans who don't normally vote. And this kind of contrarian action seems to me to be very shrewd in terms of appealing to that population. So that's probably the most important point I could make.
So in other words, his very act of disregarding the advice of his advisors, that in and of itself is something that, generally speaking, his base would see as one more example of his strength and his essential character as someone kind of overturning the tables of standard practice in Washington.
The $25 term to describe an awful lot of Trump voters is alienated. People are alienated, more bluntly angry at the status quo. And he represents that sentiment. In terms of what he says, I feel we're lucky. I'm obviously not a supporter of his. He talks a great deal and he tweets a great deal. He's not a particularly active president. In that regard, he reminds me very much of Barack Obama. Very different personalities, very different styles, but neither one is actually particularly active in terms of significant initiatives, including new laws. He's issuing lots of executive orders, which can be done with simply the stroke of a pen, because President Obama passed very little legislation. He was constantly issuing new regulations, which drive a lot of people, including Trump voters especially, crazy, and you can undo that very. But in terms of substantial historic action, it's been a long time since we had a president who did a lot. The Congress, with a Democratic majority, passed the Affordable Care Act, which is significant. And President Obama deserves and will receive credit for that. But in the case of, and already has and should, Trump actually hasn't done much, fortunately.
In terms of getting in the trenches and trying to...
that's a good way to put it, because dealing with Congress is always impossible. It's always challenging. If you actually are president, that is chief executive of the United States, it involves an awful lot of hard work. And on the positive side, I believe the first Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, as well as Bill Clinton, were both very, very significant executives. But from my biased opinion, I don't think we've seen that since. We have the celebrity president, the Oprah Winfrey for president. I mean, that's what Americans want these days, the celebrity president, or at least a lot of people want.
Some Americans.
Quite right. Thank you for correcting me.
Right. Back to President Putin. If you were an advisor to President Trump, would you have advised him not to congratulate President Putin on being reelected? And if you would have advised him that, why would you have advised him not to do that?
Perhaps phrase it more carefully. I want to congratulate you on your success in continuing in office. You have to get along with these people. Hmm. And I think good diplomacy and responsible foreign policy dictates keeping your distance. But ironically, given the fact that Trump voters are not on the left, and Russia has a left political heritage, although Putin has left communism behind, it's a little ironic that Trump's base of foreign support is, at least psychologically, in the realm of Russia and Vladimir Putin. Hmm. Quite far removed from the average American's view of the world.
Right. In a recent column, you talked about a speech that Vladimir Putin delivered on the 1st of March. So that would have been actually before the election, I think.
It was part of his campaign,
right.
A State of the Union address that's
right.
Carefully staged and a big deal in
right.
Russia.
And in this speech, of course, he made some very aggressive remarks about weaponry and so on. But you say what really was more remarkable about that speech and more newsworthy or noteworthy is the way in which he actually really focused on economic matters, and also how, in a sense, forthcoming he was in talking about Russia's relatively weak state as in terms of economic terms. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, you are, and I seized on that. I try to be a kind of serious contrarian in terms of what I write, and going beyond the headlines, which nowadays actually is fairly easy to do. Our media focused on Putin making threats and Putin announcing new nuclear weapons and Putin kind of beating his breast rhetorically about Russia's great military strength, all of which is quite inconsequential. The Russians aren't doing much that's actually new. They spend a lot of time and attention on money, and money on high-tech, highly sophisticated weaponry, because they live in fear as well as inferiority of American technology, and that's been the case since World War II. What he spent a lot of time on, so that wasn't the news, but that was the headlines, Russian threat. But he was actually quite candid, as you indicate, Greg, in talking about the weakness of the economy, and he made some fairly specific statements about how we draw new investment. In that area, he deserves a lot of credit for saving Russia from absolute anarchy, complete and total collapse, when he took over at the turn of the century, and he's been there ever since, although not always president. He has managed not only to stay in power, but to bring Russia and the Confederation of Russian States back from what was the verge of total anarchy, which wouldn't have been good for anybody. The alternative to Putin in Russia is not our kind of liberal democrat with a small d. I don't think it would be communism. I think it would be some kind of fascist militarism, which could be far more aggressive. I think if Putin were gone, any current successor, realistically, would very likely be even worse than he is for us. Mm. And that was the point I tried to communicate. Thank you for asking.
You also wrote in a recent column about the poisoning of a former Russian operative in Great Britain. He and his daughter were both poisoned in a, I guess you would call it like a chemical attack, in which a British police officer was also affected, and all of them hospitalized, I believe, in critical condition. I mean, and you...
Still,
you,
yes.
Right. Yeah. And you paint a picture of how this is a really sobering example of the way that the Russians have actually operated for a long, long time, and it's really terrifying.
It is, especially because he could be an innocent bystander. Keep in mind, there have been very few incidents like this, but in 2006, another former Russian spy was poisoned and died, and on his deathbed in London, he specifically singled out Putin in the current case, it's a nerve agent that's very exotic, very sophisticated, and is produced by Russia, and before that, the Soviet Union. It was not only very brutal, it was also very crude as well as cruel. You don't want to mess with the British in terms of national security and basic rule of law. That's why people in danger and people who are from dictatorships tend to get to go to Britain if they can. It was extremely counterproductive because Prime Minister Theresa May and her Secretary of State, Foreign Secretary, excuse me, spokespeople for other leaders of the other parties in Britain immediately denounced this. They've imposed sanctions on Russia. Obviously, Putin and company are trying to, and their predecessors are trying to send a message: don't do this, don't work for the other side. It's like joining the mafia. Don't. You can't leave. Once you join us, you don't get to leave. And if you do, we'll kill you.
Right.
Especially in today's world, it's extremely counterproductive. And Putin's reminding us that it's a country that's much more like the mafia than it should be. It's totally counterproductive.
Right.
And it in the past has been worse. There was a double agent named Oleg Penkovsky, to whom Americans owe a debt of gratitude. He's another Soviet agent, very skillful, who went to work for the United States. And during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the record is clear and detailed. He provided vital information that permitted President Kennedy and associates in that really terrible nuclear confrontation, the worst we've had, when we came very, very close to nuclear war. I don't exaggerate. He provided information and insights that helped the president and advisors to skillfully maneuver through that crisis. Now, the Soviets were so angry with him. There are reliable reports, although not evidence that would necessarily lead to a conviction in court, that the Soviets burned him alive. There's information, and there was one film of a man who appeared to be him strapped to a stretcher and then placed in a crematorium and literally incinerated while he was still living. Again, their traditional message: don't leave us, don't go to work for anyone else, we'll kill you. A system that's still that crude, that primitive, that criminal, is one that actually does not pose a significant threat to the West, to the United States, or industrial nations. Like the other 20th century dictatorships, they're trying to still operate that way, and it's ultimately counterproductive today.
So, and what you're saying is it's counterproductive for them and for their cause.
Counterproductive for them, yeah, the people who are committing these crimes. Russia has no allies. They're completely isolated. They provide some economic aid to Venezuela. Big deal. Another basket case economy. They have ties to North Korea that Pyongyang desperately uses to try to hold off Chinese influence that they don't like. No, they're an isolated country. They have no advanced industry. They have petroleum and a few and other minerals, including some exotic rare minerals that are useful in industry and aircraft. But it's a basket case economy. And Putin's genius is he's been able to not only survive, but exert Russian military influence in the world as effectively as he has. You look skeptical. That's
no,
my opinion,
no,
anyway.
No.
But
not,
there's no need to look fearful, sir. I mean, this is or look worried
no,
about
I,
this
I,
particular.
I
don't worry about him. Okay.
I'm not. It's kind of an astounding.
I realize
situation.
Russians are everywhere. I realize that they destroyed poor Hillary Clinton's camp. I realize there are Russians among us, and I'm old enough to remember when communists were also bringing us down.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
No.
It's
strong.
It's
be
quite
strong.
No,
Greg.
It's quite intriguing. I mean,
good,
it
should be.
It takes us back to my first question to you, which is, would you have advised President Trump to not congratulate President Putin?
Yeah, sure.
And I think it's if when part of our point of strength is that a country is this isolated, we should probably do all we can to keep them isolated as much as possible. I mean, whatever we do that gives Mr. Putin standing, you know, flies in the face of what you were just talking about.
So, well, this is what academics love, a purely hypothetical interchange. Now, if for some reason I wanted to advise him, which I don't, and somehow I managed to get through, and he actually listened to me, which he wouldn't. And I said, please, Mr. President, don't congratulate him. All right, this perfect. All right, another tweet congratulating Putin. So there. Okay, buddy, out of here. Yeah.
So speaking of people advising the president, he, of course, fairly recently has fired his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson.
Yeah.
This actually ties into one other really big story.
Right, that's what you said you wanted to talk about today.
Right, and and of course, that is the fact that there is at least the possibility of some kind of bridge being built, not quite literally, but maybe figuratively, between the United States and North Korea. And it would seem that some disagreement between the Secretary of State and President Trump might have led to Secretary of State Tillerson's firing. What I was really intrigued about when I read your remarks about that is that you said actually Secretary Tillerson's style has actually been largely at odds with a lot of the career diplomats who are part of the State Department. Can you just briefly explain what that rub was all about? What was his in what way was his style kind of contrary to what the State Department was used to?
Well, for one thing, and in fairness to Mr. Tillerson, former secretary, it may well be the president as much as or more than him, but a huge number of State Department slots have not been filled, including assistant secretaries, ambassadors. I think we still may be, I hope I'm wrong, I don't think we have an ambassador to South Korea. A lot of ambassadorial posts, the basic front line of international diplomacy, where on a day-to-day basis our influence is felt and give and take that's essential to countries getting along with each other and coexisting, they're not there. He had an ambitious scheme to reorganize the State Department, which was very unpopular, which does not mean it's necessarily bad. Foreign service people, like professors, tend to actually, however liberal and reformist they may be theoretically, like us professors, they tend to be very cautious and worry a lot about whether the status quo is going to be disrupted. But I think in this case it was not a well-advised system. The secretary was an extraordinarily gifted executive in a highly competitive and very important industry, the petroleum industry. He's obviously very, very able in a corporate environment, but corporate life and government life are very different, and there are people consistently who do well in one arena and are valuable who don't translate well to another. There are significant secretaries of state who have not gotten along well with department professionals, at least in relatively recent decades. During and after World War II, we still had that essential cohesion. So Secretary Dean Acheson and George Marshall, they got along well with the diplomats. They also got along extremely well with President Truman. More recently, Henry Kissinger under Nixon and Ford and James Baker under George H.W. Bush, very successful administrations in foreign policy, again, in my biased opinion. Mm. Both secretaries consciously worked outside of the State Department. Though very professional, foreign service officers would leak that, especially regarding high-stakes negotiations in the Middle East, Europe, Southeast Asia. I heard about what Secretary or National Security Advisor Kissinger talked to the other side about from their foreign office. He didn't tell us anything when he was here. Hmm. He came and went. James Baker had a small coterie, almost exclusively women, interestingly enough, which is all to the good. But he and the first President Bush were understandably obsessed with leaks, maintaining control, which I think you got to do if you're going to survive in Washington. In this case, he would operate with a few mostly outside advisors, but they both got a lot done. Hmm. So complaints from the very fine people in the Foreign Service aren't necessarily, that doesn't mean we have bad policy. I think, looking back, those leaders were extremely effective for their country. For this country, did a lot better thanks to them.
Right. I thought it was interesting at the end of your remarks about Secretary of State Tillerson, you say that the job of Secretary of State is not just a difficult one, but pretty much an impossible one.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So, It's incredibly complicated, of course, on so many levels. So what about this matter of the United States and North Korea and the possibility of the leaders of the two countries actually perhaps meeting or at least directly communicating? How big a surprise was this to you? I mean, it certainly seemed like it was an enormous surprise to most of the rest of us.
Well, sure. It's surprising. I believe the North Koreans are not as crazy, including their erratic, eccentric, great leader, Kim Jong-un. I believe there is a method to their apparent madness. Mm-hmm. And they are also in desperate straits economically. They also live in tremendous fear. Some listeners may be quite skeptical and dismissive. They live in great fear of the United States, and they have since 1953, when Dwight Eisenhower used the most ruthless, accurately described as barbaric, methods. I'm not exaggerating. This was a war. He went to great lengths, quite rightly, in my opinion, to end the Korean War. We don't think about that at all, collectively, even the serious media. It's like it was yesterday for people as well as leaders in North Korea, even if they weren't alive then. And President Trump is almost an ideal figure to increase, generate, reinforce anxiety, fear, and terror in other parts of the world, including North Korea. I hope people don't take offense at this. But that gives them a further incentive to want to get together. To actually answer your question, I think summits, this is historically undeniable, that the summit is not a place for negotiation. It's a showplace to sign the agreement with great theater and great ceremony that's been already negotiated by subordinates. In 1972, Nixon helped get himself reelected by going to the Soviet Union and signing the two strategic arms limitation treaties. With Brezhnev and associates, Kissinger and his deputies had worked for literally, not just months, years, to bring together this Winston Lord, a dedicated public servant, a fine diplomat, and just a wonderful human being, along with his wife, a Chinese woman, Betty Bao Lord, both great people as well as diplomats. He's received some recognition. He should get more for actually doing the work for Henry Kissinger and, in turn, the president. But that's the way these summits should be handled. But just picking up a phone, sending out emails and tweets and saying, hey, let's get together, that's not a good idea.
Hmm. Well, it's going to be interesting to see where that all goes, isn't
yeah.
it? And if anything comes of it, good or bad or indifferent, but
right.
certainly it was a dramatic move that not too many people saw coming.
Well, people should not be... whether or not you're offended by what I just said, you should, I think on balance, it's good that they're talking, and I hope that no seat-of-the-pants agreements are reached, so to speak, that are not in our long-term interest. But partly because of the crazy rhetoric, since 1953, actually since 1950, they started this with loudspeakers during the Korean War. North Korea has been typified by this kind of wild, uncontrolled, very insulting rhetoric. But there has been a method in the last few years to this apparent madness.
Yeah. Interesting phrase. Well, on that note, it looks like we have to finish things out, but I look forward to you joining us in April. There's a lot more to talk about. Among other things, I'm anxious to hear your thoughts on what perhaps might be a significant movement on behalf of greater gun control, a movement taken up
sure.
by the young people of the country, and I'm interested to hear your perspective on that and, of course, on many, many other things, including the state of the American economy and some of these recent elections and what they say about the midterms coming up this fall in terms of what things are looking like. But the clock says it's time to finish out. So Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being part of the morning show today.
Well, thank you, Greg. You're kind. I'm glad I can come back. I'll be back. Okay.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, featuring Easter candy, new apparel, and garden accessories in its recently remodeled gift shop. Open Monday through Friday from 9 until 6, Saturday 9 to 5. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.